Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mike. It's time.
I hear it in my dreams
oh,
now.
Oh, I hear it every day walking around in life. It's like my theme music, like the Family Guy episode where Stewie follows the fat guy around with the tuba.
I fell on my face the other day and I thought like there was a pumpkin underneath me. That's how many times I've watched this movie.
Wait, so in the personification of you putting yourself into this movie, you are not Michael Myers nor the final girl. You are Tommy Doyle the child?
Tommy Doyle the child. The boogeyman! I've watched it 5 times in 2 weeks, Michael. What have you done to me?
Yeah, you might have some mental problems now. I see you're all dressed in orange, too, like a pumpkin today.
It's an hour and 20-minute movie. I dressed in orange on purpose. Also went with the New York Knicks hat.
Wow. Yes, and we're back. Welcome once again to another episode of Mike, and Oscar.
Podcasting.
I am your co-host, Mike One. This is co-host also Mike.
A non-visual format. Yes, I am also Mike. I'm hyped for this review. I'm a little feeling under pressure here.
You should.
David Bowie.
You should. This is going to be very, very critical on my end.
Because it's your favorite movie.
Yes.
And we're recording in the same day A Star is Born later on.
Yes.
Which might be the Best Picture winner. So we got to come through today.
I'm hoping that this movie is better than A Star is Born.
Look, pressure performers perform under pressure.
That's right. And like also Mike just alluded to, we're going further with our Halloween franchise. MMO Does Halloween, this big recap series that we're doing in the lead up to the new Halloween movie coming out on the 19th of October, the David Gordon Green sequel, remake, reboot, however you want to classify it. And we just did Season of the Witch. That was our first. That was our kickoff. The only Halloween movie that is a non-Michael Myers property. And today we're getting into the meat and the nitty-gritty of the actual series. The first Halloween movie, John Carpenter's horror classic from 1978, and that's what we're going to be going into and giving a deep dive through today.
So after this one, we're going to take them two at a time.
Yes.
We just decided.
Yes.
In our production, miniature production meeting, so, you know, we'll get to build some momentum faster, but we have to dedicate the time in one episode to this baby.
Now, that said, these are older movies. We are going to give spoilers. There will not be a spoiler section. This isn't an Oscar Sprint profile. This is more like Mission Impossible series recap we did, the MCU review that we did.
This is like 60 minutes of us high-fiving and heavy petting and whatever else you want to call it.
Deep, deep breathing on my end. Yeah, don't worry if you hear that from my microphone. But this is what we're doing today. Halloween. MMO Does Halloween. We got Season of the Witch out of the way. That was awesomely bad. Be sure you caught up on that.
That was fun.
One of the funnier episodes I think we've put out. But
we are so talented and funny.
I imagine this one's going to be more serious.
Yeah.
As this is more of a cinematic, an actual institution in the history and the annals of cinema.
I've written very little shtick, although I will make fun of you for saying annals right there.
Yeah, I was hoping I could get away with it, but good job calling me out. Let's start, Michael, with some introduction stuff. So why are we doing Halloween? Well, I think that's pretty obvious. Obviously, the remake helps us out with that, but also it is Halloween 1, specifically this one, is one of the more institutions in all of the horror genre. There's a documentary online, a great YouTube documentary, or at least it's on YouTube, about the making of Halloween 1. They have deep dive interviews. Tommy Lee Wallace, who's actually the director of Halloween 3, right, also worked on this movie. John Carpenter, the director, obviously his writing partner at the time, who also was a co-producer of this, Mustafa Akkad, is in this. Jamie Lee Curtis, etc. They have interviews with everybody. Really great deep dive. We both watched that on top of watching this film, Halloween 1.
Yeah, I just tweeted the YouTube link. It is Halloween 1978, The Inside Story. It's on YouTube. Go watch it. I watched it years ago, and then, I mean, I know you fall asleep to it.
Right, yeah. We both watched it recently, for educational purposes, and me as my white noise machine for the past 25 years to pass out to.
That is disturbing, yes.
But they make the point in that documentary that horror movies, and John Carpenter is on record saying this, that really began with Hitchcock, specifically his Psycho. Mike, you're a student of history and film history.
Mostly
all those
film history.
Separately and congruently. Do you agree with that statement? What's your take on where we are and how we got to this point in 1978 with horror movies and Halloween being coming to be?
Yes, Hitchcock in many ways made the most popular film that involved a monster that was a person. Coming out of World War II, you know, we had science creating monsters. We had, before that, you know, the old Universal Hollywood monsters, you know, the traditional Wolfmans,
sure,
and Frankensteins and vampires,
Bela
and
Lugosi,
zombies.
Golden Age, yep.
Yeah, so we had a lot of that type of horror films. We had some sci-fi horror in the 50s, and now we basically get this modern horror, which is, you know, serial murders running amok. We get these killers who are, we think, just people, and we'll get into that with Mr. Myers here. But yes, he wasn't the only one. You had Clouseau over in Europe, and he was pumping out films in the 40s, 50s, 60s. You had The Eyes Without a Face. You had a lot of good movies that were based on this kind of modern horror principle. I'm sure I'm forgetting some names as well. But yes, John Carpenter took it to another level when this movie became a phenomenon.
Yeah, it's really always a fascinating take whenever you get into what Hitchcock did, because he really was so ahead of his time. And he really is... If John Carpenter is the master of horror, such as his surname, and it's actually what his Twitter handle is, which I think is awesome, Hitchcock is kind of like the grandfather. He did introduce a lot of these modern methods.
The grand poobah.
Exactly. And even while Hitchcock was finding his footing in like the 40s and 50s, we had stuff like Peeping Tom, which was one of the first movies that put the audience in the killer's POV.
Right.
We had the Fritz Lang classic German film, 1931's M, where it kind of had the cult mentality, and it was one of the first ones to play a trick on the audience, sir. Where you think you're going against the bad guy and really the audience becomes the antagonist, and it's really a double twist there.
So this is like every trick in the book thrown at you, cinema.
Exactly.
And it's an
amalgamation that has led up to the creation of the Michael Myers character that is now here in 1978. John Carpenter doing this right out of college, Jamie Lee Curtis doing this right out of school. This is a fascinating look in time about one of the biggest moments in cinematic history, if not horror history, certainly.
It's manipulative filmmaking, but at its best. And like I just said, every trick that a filmmaker has, he's throwing it at you within this genre. And it's really a celebration of a lot of those techniques. And we're gonna cover them throughout
and
this
the predecessors, sure, certainly. So let's go through. Let's start off 1978. This is where we are. Everything that we've done thus far with the Hitchcockians and with the M's and with the Peeping Toms of the world has led up to this moment. This is the forefather of the Jasons, the forefather of Wes Craven's Scream franchise. Often duplicated, but really never replicated. Halloween, Michael Myers, cast and crew, 1978's production. Go for it, Mike.
John Carpenter's the director, co-writer, and composer
film.
Carpenter had made Dark Star and Assault on Precinct 13 in 1974 and 76. Before that, he completed 7 short films at USC Film School, at least those were credited on IMDb. And he was the editor on a 1973 film, Last Foxtrot in Burbank. That one has not aged well necessarily. But Michael, after Halloween became that cultural phenomenon, Carpenter would go on to write, compose, and direct The Fog, Escape from New York, The Thing, Christine, Starman, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, They Live, Memoirs of an Invisible Man, In the Mouth of Madness, Village of the Damned, Escape from L.A., Vampires, Ghosts of Mars, and The Ward, his last directorial effort coming in 2010.
Wasn't terrible, by the way. Not bad.
Right. Two questions for you. Of the non-Halloween films that I just mentioned in the Carpenter filmography, number one, what's his best film? And number two, what's your sentimental favorite of that group?
So with the caveat on this that I have not seen Ghosts of Mars yet, and I don't care what the 4.9 IMDb rating on that movie says, I know that since it's Carpenter,
I
see it, I'll love it. So I haven't seen that yet. I keep meaning to, and I just haven't gotten around to it. I think his technical best, where he really was his crescendo, people could argue it was Halloween, which you never like to peek at your first one, but if this is one of the greatest horror movies of all time. I think technically his best one is The Thing, because I think it's just a creation, and it's a collection of all the little tricks he's had. And we talked about borrowing from Hitchcock and borrowing from all the horror masters previously. He kind of honed his craft with Halloween, but once he got to The Thing...
His second best score, by the way.
You think so?
I love that thing.
It is very good. It is very haunting.
It's so simple, but it just works.
Well, that's the thing about all his scores, too. They're so easily replicated, but he's the one that put them on. But anyway, I think he took it what worked really well as far as a methodical pacing, the silence, bumps in the night, off-camera lighting that you can only see half of the big bad boogeyman in the dark, hiding the villain, added more horror elements to have a really special sauce cooking of something truly cinematic and truly legendary. Getting to work with Kurt Russell and Keith David, really masters of their craft, and talking about how they act as well. I really think it all came together in 1982's The Thing, and that's probably my favorite movie of his, technically speaking. My sentimental favorite, non-Halloween favorite, is either Prince of Darkness or In the Mouth of Madness. Both those movies are insane. And I watch Prince of Darkness every single year. I have it.
I have not seen that.
Donald Pleasence is in that as well, because of course he is. Alice Cooper is a hobo alien type.
It's
absurd horror is your thing. If campy, absurd B-movie horror is your thing, You can't go wrong with In the Mouth of Madness. Go watch Prince of Darkness. It's absurd.
I'm going to have to watch Prince of Darkness then. All right. Came away with a
recommendation. I have it on Blu-ray and Special Edition. I can let you borrow them both. Please do not ruin them.
Okay. I'm walking away with something today, folks. Anyway, Carpenter also wrote most of his work and composed the music as well. Like I said, that is talent. One of the first moves John Carpenter made after he, an executive producer on Halloween, Irwin Yablans, got this project off the ground was to bring Deborah Hill on board. Deborah Hill is the co-writer and producer on Halloween.
Somebody who doesn't get nearly enough credit as far as one of the forefathers or foremothers, I guess, of women in cinematic writing and cinematic history.
Trailblazing career, absolutely. No doubt, as many have mentioned in that documentary. Carpenter had worked with Hill on Assault on Precinct 13. She was the script supervisor there, and they built up a lot of trust, as Carpenter mentioned during those interviews. So Hill had a long producing career in Hollywood after Halloween, including most of the John Carpenter films, plus some other notables, Michael. The Dead Zone, Clue, Adventures in Babysitting, The Fisher King, Crazy Alabama jumped off the page for me.
I think I read they're remaking Clue.
Oh, really?
Why?
Yes, I heard that, too.
Don't do that. That movie, that's a moment in time, that movie.
You like that ending.
Endings.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Deborah Hill tragically died of cancer in 2005. Yes, she worked right up to the end there, but she did not pass away before what turned out to be an illustrious career, Michael. She also wrote The Fog, Halloween 2, and Escape from L.A. A couple fun facts about Deborah Hill. She actually wore the Michael Myers costume.
Yes.
For one of the iconic shots across the street.
Yes.
Just the lights of the house on, that's it, and she's in silhouette. She was also the hands grabbing the knife from the six-year-old Michael at the beginning of the film. Other key crew members, high school friend and production designer, like you said, Tommy Lee Wallace, who just we talked about for directing Halloween 3.
Carpenter's.
We get you.
Yeah, for thank some you reason.
For letting me finish that.
Sorry, I stepped all over you. But he's kind of been Carpenter's right-hand man for a while, and that's kind of also why he was entrusted with Halloween 3, the first non-Michael Myers property.
Yes, Dean Cundley was the director of photography. He'd go on to shoot Jurassic Park, Hook, and Apollo 13, amongst others, getting an Oscar nomination for Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Which is timeless. An absolutely timeless movie.
That scared the poop.
Oh my God, it's Dip!
Scared the poop out of me when I was a little kid. Little kid.
I killed your brother!
Oh my God.
And I talked just like this!
Terrifying. For a little child?
Oh, Christopher Lloyd is amazing. Yes.
Yes. James Winburn would be put in charge of the stunts. Winburn coordinated 78 credits worth of stunts in his career, a mainstay for Carpenter films, as well as Tron, Glory, and Magnum P.I. And Craig Stearns did the set decoration, The Mask, an Emmy nomination for the Stephen King adaptation Rose Red TV miniseries, and 24 Legacy are other Stearns highlights.
Did you ever see Rose Red?
I did. It was all right.
I wanted to see it, but I never got around to it.
The book was better, as most Stephen King adaptations, but it was solid.
Set decoration, I don't think, gets enough credit for this movie, too. You actually have to know the backstory, which is one of the things the documentary does touch on. This is supposed to be Chicago, or, you know, Illinois, in Halloween, in late October, early November, and they had to film it, like they said, in L.A. in July,
right.
And all they did was paint a couple leaves and throw them around and all that stuff. And
I love all those little nuggets.
It was great. Yeah, they really pulled it off.
And as a veteran of a lot of very tiny independent film productions, I love the fact that all the set decorators are just the cast and crew.
Oh, yeah.
They're all doing it.
And they were the wardrobe masters, too. They basically had to wear their own clothing from home and rip it up. Yeah, it was
amazing.
Great backstory.
To get into the cast here, Jamie Lee Curtis plays Laurie Strode.
Who?
She is the daughter of Hollywood royalty Janet Lee and Tony Curtis. Jamie Lee also married one of my favorite people in Hollywood, Christopher Guest, since 1984. I call him Chris. Curtis has...
CG to his friends.
JLC has played Laurie Strode 5 times in Halloween's 1, 2, H2O, Resurrection, and coming soon in this year's Halloween 2018.
We don't have to talk about Resurrection. The other 4 are great.
The Fog, Prom Night, Terror Train, and of course Halloween 2. Those are her other Scream Queen roles in the 80s there. She rode that train for a little bit.
You should watch The Fog. We've referenced The Fog a bunch because it is important. 1980 film from Carpenter, but you should watch it.
I love the misdirection jump scares in that movie.
Great movie.
So good.
The ending is off the fucking walls.
Yes. Jamie Lee Curtis broke out of that Scream Queen persona, though, with her late to mid 80s with comedies like Trading Places and A Fish Called Wanda. I love both both of those movies. She was also excellent in a lot of kids' movies throughout my childhood, Michael. My Girl 1 and 2, House Arrest, Freaky Friday, I don't really have a connection with. Neither do I know Beverly Hills Chihuahua very much. That's a little after my kiddom. But she's made a career with those child movies.
And I think it's important to note, too, she's never been the type to be disappointed or embarrassed for where she started. She's always held the Laurie Strode role very close and personal to her, to the extent that she was the one responsible for, at least according to Carpenter, bringing up the idea for H2O 20 years later.
Yes. Fans basically badgered her to the point where, like, John, we got to do another yeah, one.
Pretty much.
20 years later is the time to do it.
Yeah, but she had to be talked into coming back to do Laurie Strode. She didn't want to sully the name of it. She talks about in very reverent tones how she cares about the franchise, she knows how important it is to certain fans and has always been good to her. So it's just nice to see for me. I mean, I know I'm unhealthily attached to this franchise as it is, but you see how many times people in Hollywood don't like to kind of shut away from their early days and just getting their feet wet. And she's always kind of kept it close to her chest.
I just love this character so much, too, because it's a cowering, crying mess who then takes all the agency in the world and fights this effort back.
Badass.
And it's just so badass. Yes. Love it. So Jamie Lee Curtis has had a little bit of a renaissance lately on TV. She was on New Girl and Scream Queens over the past few years.
One of the most ridiculous death scenes in history was on Scream Queens.
Oh, really? But, Michael, I think my favorite non-Halloween JLC role came in 1994's True Lies. I don't know about you. What a role. What a movie that was.
You're a big James Cameron guy, too, though. All those epics that he does before he decided to get lost in Blue World here with Avatar.
Yes, sir. Donald Pleasance played Dr. Loomis in Halloween. 1984, The Great Escape, Cul-de-Sac, and Escape from New York.
You ever seen Cul-de-sac?
I have not seen
Cul-de-sac. What a weird movie that is.
Polanski, right?
Yes. Yes.
I don't think I've seen that one. I have to, I guess.
You don't.
Okay. That's a long, illustrious filmography from Pleasance. Maybe we'll do more of a bio on him later on. But he was a key get for this tiny production that Michael have a spec on in a few minutes.
Yeah, he was like the get.
Right. Nancy Kies, who we talked about in Halloween 3, she is Annie in this film, daughter of Officer Brackett, chauffeuring Donald Pleasance around town, friend of Laurie Strode. Brackett was played by Charles Cyphers, also known from other Carpenter films, The Fog, etc., and Major League. We have Kies, just a throwback to that last episode there. Yes, she was the ex-wife of Tommy Lee Wallace going into this movie, and she goes on to marry a guy named Loomis.
You ever seen that Robert De Niro, Wesley Snipes movie, The Fan?
Okay.
Where Wesley Snipes is a pitcher for the San Francisco Giants and Robert...
Unfortunately, yes.
And he's obsessed with him.
Yes.
Maybe that's what Nancy Kies is here. She's just a really big fan of the Halloween series.
And it's a fan fantasy because they cast her in
it,
movie.
And now she needs to marry a Loomis.
Well, she only has 9 credits on her IMDb, Mike. She retired from her acting career rather young. She is now a sculptor and teaching acting classes at Cal Poly. So I'm going to do a lot of that Where Are They Now kind of stuff for the rest of this cast here, Michael.
It's important, too, because a lot of these people, this was one of their only credits or their only credit on IMDb. This is really a fascinating look behind the scenes.
So PJ Souls, she was the biggest name actress at the time of this movie's creation. She was known from Carrie and TV movies going into Halloween. Souls played the totally telephone-corded high school girl, Linda.
Totally.
She said that perfect. That's what got her cast. Souls would go on to 65 more acting credits on IMDb. She is still acting. She's also known for me in Stripes and Rock and Roll High School. So her boyfriend in the film, John Michael Graham, plays Bob. He has a run-in with Michael up against the wall later in this movie.
I love how his picture on IMDb, because this is another guy that wasn't in a lot of things. Mm-hmm. This is certainly his biggest title that he's ever been. And his picture on IMDb is still the Bob character from Halloween.
Yes. I also say his most famous quote to you early and often in our meetings together, don't get dressed. That's the weirdest joke ever.
Didn't see that coming, but all right. Yeah,
it
sure.
It just came to me. Kylie Richards plays Lindsay, and Brian Andrews plays Tommy in 1978's Halloween. There were the two kids being babysat here. Richards has 42 credits on IMDb, including a long stint on ER. Andrews has 23 credits. He mostly did the child acting thing, The Great Santini, 3 O'Clock High, but he's still acting today as well. And last but not least, Nick Castle played The Shape.
And he's back. Yes. Played The Shape in 78. 40 years later, they returned. He's back playing The Shape in 2018.
The man behind the mask giving Michael Myers many of his trademark mannerisms with his performance. Though the head tilt was definitely a Carpenter direction.
Iconic.
Yeah, as they have all had said with the Bob character there.
And that's why John Carpenter is better at his job than 90% of directors.
Yes, sir. Castle would go on to a long career as a writer-director, go figure. He wrote Escape from New York, Hook, and August Rush.
How much talent was in this production? Yeah. My lord.
He'd go on to direct The Last Starfighter, The Boy Who Could Fly, Dennis the Menace, and Major Payne. Michael, how about those last two titles from our childhoods?
I was obsessed with Dennis the Menace. Mr. Wilson!
It was good, right?
It wasn't Walter bad. Matthau. Yeah, it wasn't bad at all. Walter Matthau, he was a gem.
Talk about Christopher Lloyd there. Yeah. Gross and funny. Mike, you have the specs.
Do some specs for Halloween, and guys, I promise this is only take 3 hours tops for me to get through. As also Mike said, Halloween is co-written, scored, and directed by John Carpenter. That guy was awfully busy for a $10,000 stipend that he was paid to do this movie from the production studio.
My God.
Deborah Hill also co-wrote and produced, and don't worry about Carpenter, he also held on to 10% of the profits that this movie would make in perpetuity.
Oh, I see. That's $5 million right there, baby.
The famed executive producers are Irwin Yablans and Mustafa Akkad. Falcon International Pictures was the production company in charge, and the film was distributed by Compass International Pictures, which is Yablans' company, an Aquarius releasing film runs for 91 minutes. It first released on October 25th, 1978. So why does that matter? Well, it didn't get famous until 1979, late 1979,
crazy.
Like Halloween 1979, which is nuts. Halloween was met with tepid critical reviews when it first came out and box office as well. After two film critics, one from The Village Voice, this is directly from the documentary, one from The Village Voice, the other the famed Roger Ebert, after their reviews came out, which were for The Village Voice months after the initial release date, right. And for Roger Ebert's almost a year, if not more, after the original release date, the movie finally caught fire with audiences. RogerEbert.com, which houses the famed critic's lifetime of work and all his reviews, dates his review for Halloween as being done October 31st, 1979. Wow. 79. Or in other words, more than an entire year after the theatrical release of the film. So talk about a slow starter.
Slow starter, and it's weird how films were released back then. Regional releases,
yes.
They go from one city to another like a traveling circus almost. And it's just, it's thrilling to see that a year later, this thing blows up and becomes
and it's phenomenon. It's kind of amazing, too, when you think about it, that this can't really happen anymore.
Right.
Just because of social media and overexposure and oversaturation and all the outlets of streaming and home box office, etc., you're not going to have a small indie picture catch fire. You could do it at a festival.
I guess it can happen on video or something if it comes out and the critics really slam it and then the audiences really love it later on, like us.
You would need a unique, unique picture for that to happen, but yeah. Box office and home video sales is obviously where everybody is very, very happy with Halloween up to this date. Halloween would go on to gross a total of $70 million. Now, obviously, not the hugest number in the world. Certainly not one of the bigger ones that we've
back
talked
then,
about on this show. But yes, for back then, for 1978-79 purposes, that's quite substantial, and it still does make some history today. $70 million is the worldwide box office number. $47 million of that came domestically. $23 million internationally. Truly amazing when you consider that not only was it a slow starter, but despite the latter positive critical reviews, it was pretty split amongst critics at the time of release. So again, it did get that positive traction, but not on first release. This thing probably should have died, and everybody attached to it in the documentary admitted they thought it did die after its initial run.
A platform release, to be sure, if the platforms were like the steps leading up to the Ace Ventura 2 temple that he's studying
slinky.
As a monk.
A slinky!
Okay.
Who knows what Halloween made on home video? VH copies are now a collector's item. One famously sold on eBay in 2013 from the 1978 original cut for $13,000.
Unbelievable.
I was not the owner of that, nor the purchaser, unfortunately.
You wish.
I do. On DVD, Numbers.com says it's grossed over $6 million in DVD sales and another $500,000 in Blu-rays. Those numbers do seem a tad small.
Yeah, I don't think they're calculating everything there. DVD... Yes, it makes sense that it may not have made a ton of money. It made most of its money on VHS, right?
But sure, but still, there have been I know the 35th anniversary edition came out, the 40th anniversary 5 years or 5 years ago, the 35th anniversary.
Looking at your shelf of DVDs, I think it would have made a lot more.
I know the for the 35th anniversary, they had two different Blu-ray sets. One was 16 discs, one was 11 discs. It was like $200, $150. So I'm sure those numbers are a little off, but regardless. Domestically, the Halloween franchise films have grossed over $308 million, plus another $204 million internationally, for a total over $512 million thus far.
Those are huge.
Adjusted for inflation, that number is over $1 billion, 693 or so domestically, according to Box Office Mojo. Amazing in its own right as a collection, but important to note that Box Office Mojo has its $47 million domestic box office, even when not adjusted for inflation. So we're talking $47 million, 1979 dollars,
right.
Still ranking as the 14th highest grossing slasher film ever and the 79th highest domestic box office for all R-rated horror ever.
And it's mostly profit because these movies are costing at most like $10 million down the line.
Oh, yeah, especially this one. Especially this one. And its unadjusted $47 million domestic box office is still the third best for any Halloween movie ever. Even now, some 40 years later, it'll probably slip to fourth, though, in a couple weeks.
Yes, sir. The projections are large.
I can't wait. Budget. Let's talk about the budget. The infamous budget with a great backstory attached to it. As legend states, or as we were told in the documentary directly, Halloween 1978, the Inside Story, which is on YouTube. Executive producer Irwin Yablans approached John Carpenter after his work on Assault and Precinct 13 about making a movie about a killer who stalks babysitters. They wanted to call it The Babysitter Murders.
Not as good of a title.
Carpenter wanted work, and he admits there as much as he didn't want to do horror. He was a big fan of old Hollywood. He was a big fan of Westerns.
Right.
That was his desire, but he instead said, you know what? This is a paycheck. Let me grab onto it. I can do it now. I at least be something to add to my CV. Yablans approached Carpenter, said, hey, what do you think it'll cost to make this movie? And Carpenter threw out the number of $300,000. Then Carpenter demanded that if I'm going to make this, I need two things. I need Final Cut, and I need my name above the title. Ambitious.
But something that Carpenter thought could work in his favor, because he's seen a lot of other directors that he idolized over the years, like Howard Hawks, say, push themselves as a director to market themselves as a brand, and this turned out to work for him.
Well, yeah, but think about the balls it takes to say, I need my name above the title because I know this is going to work. on one of your first films.
Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, whoever did that
right.
one.
This exactly.
Is Joe Schmo is the Puppet Master with the Littlest Reich there. Yeah, it's crazy.
The story goes, Donald Pleasance cost them $25,000 to bring in, and Yablans got them the additional $25,000 to shoot with, doubling the casting budget and bumping the overall budget to $325,000.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that worked out for them. Going back to the critical reception to finish up, the film now stands on Rotten Tomatoes with a certified fresh 93% rating on 56 critical reviews, average carrying an 8.6 out of 10 critics.
So those numbers went way up.
Not
from
bad.
The 50s to the 80s and 90s.
Not bad. 89% audience score on nearly 302,000 user reviews, where it currently sits as the only Halloween movie, regardless of cinematic timeline or universe, with a critical rating over 52%, which I thought was interesting.
Hmm.
Also, a lot of people are wrong. IMDb audiences also gave it a 7.8 out of 10 on 186,000 plus reviews, while it carries a 78 meta rating as well, including that historically important 100 from Roger Ebert on behalf of the Chicago Sun-Times.
Fascinating. Though those numbers will be redeemed with this year's film in many ways, or those franchises.
Fingers crossed. I'm praying so, man.
So some production nuggets here, Mike. We covered most of the stuff already, but some fun facts. Deborah Hill grew up in Haddonfield, New Jersey.
How's that relevant?
Dr. Loomis is named after the John Gavin character in Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho.
And that's one of the biggest indications that John Carpenter truly was a student of film. He knew the kind of the gravitas he wanted to handle and be a disciple of Hitchcock in.
Now, Michael, if there was a serial killer movie and they named the two killers Mike and Mike with our names attached to them, and there was a Mike and an even worse killer named Oscar, would you feel that as a tribute to us?
Yes.
Well, that's what happened. John Carpenter named the character of The Shape after Michael Myers, the film critic, who particularly loved Carpenter's film Assault on Precinct 13 the most. So this was like his number one fan film critic, and this character, Michael Myers, was a tribute to film critic Michael Myers back in the 70s.
Well, let me be the first as an amateur film critic to say to David Gordon Green, I can't wait for your sequel.
As for the iconic mask, during the production, they just went to a normal costume shop to buy a selection and bring them back to the costume guys on the film. They had a Nixon mask, a sad clown, and a Captain Kirk one, many of the crew wanted them to go with the sad clown. That was the creepiest
yes.
at the time, or at least on its face there. In face.
It's actually one of the same masks that the Heath Ledger's Joker henchman wore in the right. opening shot of the Dark
right.
Knight.
A mask just like that, yeah. and that was super creepy. But they eventually chose the William Shatner slash Captain Kirk one because it was plainer, right? They can manipulate it a little more, and that's what they did. They changed the hair, they cut open the eye sockets a little wider, and they painted the face white for an iconic move.
Right, if you'll indulge me for a couple minutes, I have a personal story that relates to that. The first year I wanted to go as Michael Myers for right. Halloween, I tasked my mother, she was coming home from work, can you just stop and pick me up a Michael Myers mask? Because I had a Halloween party that night after school and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
She didn't know who Michael Myers was, obviously. So she comes home with this mask, and she said, the guy at the store said this was it. And,
uh-huh.
it was a Captain Kirk mask. I swear to God, it was a William Shatner wow. mask. And I was upset. I was so dejected because I didn't know at the time that Michael Myers was based on Captain. I thought it
that
was...
super nerd.
Yeah, exactly. My brother and his now wife, then girlfriend, took it upon themselves. I was sulking. I was a big baby, whining, being thought I couldn't go to the party.
A bunch of sweet people.
I don't even know if he knew this, but they just started covering it in white. And I yep. noticed as they were covering it in white paint, I was like, that looks strikingly similar to the Michael Myers mask. They found some random hair around. They did up the hair. It looked just like it. I found out by that practice yes. that the Michael Myers mask was based on Captain Kirk, and then read about it later. And I was like, oh, that's why it worked out so well.
That's awesome.
Yes. Great story.
Yes. Great story. Good job. And thank you, Shmave, for enriching your younger brother's life there. That's wonderful. So just a few quick things to finish here. They cast unknowns for this film because they had no budget for it, but they were thrilled to cast the daughter of Psycho's ultimate scream queen. John Carpenter had said during that documentary that it was a major influence on them. Janet Leigh, you know, and Psycho being a major influence on this film. So Jamie Lee Curtis had to be cast there. They originally asked Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing,
yes,
General Tarkin and Saruman themselves to play the Dr. Loomis role. Those yes. guys had been in like every Vincent Price type role of every sure. horror movie of those last few decades. But Carpenter was like, it'll just be another Christopher Lee movie. It'll
I
just
think
be
Christopher Lee really would have hurt this.
Right. It'll just be another
because he's too famous. Exactly. They're too famous.
So Carpenter was a huge fan of Westerns, and Donald Pleasance was in a lot of those. And we have Yablons agreeing to bump that budget up, and Pleasance agreeing to do it because his daughter was a big fan of the music on Assault on Precinct 13.
How weird. Crazy is these little just happenstance moments in time that become institutions of cinematic history. Yeah, I'll do this movie with this nobody.
Necessity, right? Necessity's yeah. just... Anyway, they're out of money. They still had to cast Michael Myers. Carpenter turned to his friend Nick Castle, a film school buddy of his, and I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't have to act much. He's like, I'm not an actor. You don't have to ask yeah. act much. You're
just
in a
walk.
Mask.
Just walk this
walk
way.
Around.
Tilt your head this way.
You have a creepy walk. You're a creepy guy. You're yeah. a film school
that's
student.
That's the subtext of that. You, my friend, are weird.
Yes. You're weird enough to pull this off just naturally. Just be yourself. So Carpenter is notorious for not giving his actors much direction on set. He basically thinks that if I hire you, they have it in them to do the job and they should just do it. So he told John Michael Graham, who was almost in tears after he said this, hit your spot and say your line, when Michael Graham was just asking him for some notes or asking him what he's
like
supposed to
do. Giving you what you want, yeah.
And years
just
later.
Shut up!
Years later, you know, that's kind of like Hitchcock. Hitchcock was just like, they are cattle to be paraded in front of the camera. And, you know, Carpenter's like that. He had that mentality. And now we have him doing it again to his actors, and maybe that's why John Michael Graham never acted in anything else
yeah,
after this.
He was scarred.
But he could appreciate it years later because in his mind, he's rationalized it as, all right, he believed in me.
You know what I find fascinating about John Michael Graham as a person? He doesn't have many acting credits, but he was so readily available for that document. Like, he couldn't have been hard to find. What has he been doing?
You think he would just get, like, you know, fan favorite roles
right,
from
right, or at least
B-horror
parody
movies.
Roles. B-roll. Yeah, exactly.
He's probably
yeah.
like a Wall Street banker now or something. He doesn't need this.
Tech genius over in Silicon Valley.
Probably got the best podcast around.
He is Google. This is certain. It's John Michael Graham.
John Michael
dash Google.
Graham Google. Tommy Lee Wallace had the best quote of the doc, though. He said that Carpenter spent most of his budget to make sure of three things. One, it was shot in Panavision with the best lenses they had in the industry. Two, that it was processed at MGM Labs, so it got the best editing.
He's no dummy.
And then they did its post work for its sound at Goldwyn Sound, the best sound house in town.
So let this be a lesson to all the, whether it's filmmaking or writing or any kind of, just because you are not at the pinnacle of your field, you could still maximize your output and maximize your product. In terms of
technology, yeah. Right. I mean, we spent a lot of money on this podcasting equipment, even though we're a podunk little operation here.
Yes.
Plot review, Mike, and this is basically what we're going to do for this episode. We're not going to have a lot of segments. We're going to gush over scene by scene what this movie
is. Yeah, also, a combination of my excitement and my exuberance and the information that we wanted to make sure that was highlighted about one of the most important horror films in cinematic history is why the preface, if you will, went so long. But like Mike said, we're not going to do best scene, worst scenes, et cetera, et cetera. We're just going to work it all in as we go through the plot step by step. And Michael is going to take the helm with that.
So I'm basically going to give you a scene. You're going to comment. I'll comment once in a while.
It was awesome!
We're going to do the Chris Farley Show thing.
Remember? You remember that? Remember when he killed that babysitter?
So, here we go. 15 years after murdering his sister on Halloween night, 1963, Michael Myers escapes from a mental hospital and returns to the small town of Haddonfield to kill again. That is the IMDb premise, Michael. You're going to see that movie, aren't you?
Absolutely, and it totally just drives by, which is what is undoubtedly the most impressive shot of the entire movie, which is the opening.
The first sequence of the movie, the the tracking or the Steadicam. Now it's called Steadicam.
Right.
They had some kind of Panavision camera doing that. 70-pound apparatus onto the DP.
All in one take.
Yeah, and he's moving quick, too. Oh, yeah. Which is crazy in that sequence. I loved it. So, first of all, though, we have those opening credits that are iconic. The black backdrop, the jack-o'-lantern,
how much the you music. Think, how much money do you think that took to shoot? 15 cents?
Not a lot, and it's
$3 so for economic. The pumpkin and $1 for the knife.
Showcases the music like an old Hollywood epic, right?
And right off the bat, we're told exactly that the score is going to be important. The score is not only it leaves an imprint on your mind immediately, but you get the sense of dread that you need to have with it, and you're told that this score means something ominous is coming.
It was crazy because they screened the film for so many Hollywood executives, mm-hmm. right? And the backstory goes that after they added the score, they screened it to the same executives who didn't like the movie at first. Loved the movie after that. I was so wrong about this movie, one of them said. And John Carpenter was like, wow, that's the effect of music. So how about this opening scene? POV of a six-year-old Michael Myers in a clown Halloween outfit. His babysitter / sister is doing some hanky-panky with her boyfriend.
Don't Michael have is, sex. If you're a character in a horror movie, stop having sex.
Six-year-old Michael is the peeping Tom, watching them in the window, watching them go upstairs, walking around the house, the boyfriend giving her the quickiest of quickies in the history of premature ejaculators. We have this
love, but enough about us.
Yeah, love making lasting only a few moments, but this clown costume kid grabs a kitchen knife and then walks up the stairs, puts on the mask, where it's actually the only cut of the sequence where he just puts on the mask and get a screen dark for a half a second, which allowed them to do this without all going crazy and taking a 21-day shoot into 29-day shoot. But you have the six-year-old Michael Myers in a horrifying fashion killing his sister, who's naked in her dressing scenario up against a mirror. Horrifying. You have him walk back down the stairs, kind of bobbling the camera. You have a neighbor out on Halloween night saying, Michael. And then they flip off the mask.
Was that his parents? I thought that was his parents.
Parents, neighbor, yeah, doesn't matter, pull back apparently. From this little kid.
In a clown outfit with a bloody knife. Bloody big butcher's knife. Has to be one of the first, well, first of all, one of the longest one-take shots in horror history, right. I would think, because horror was a relatively new genre, or the slasher genre was kicked off, essentially, with this movie.
This is like Sam Raimi Evil Dead innovation, right?
In terms of filmmaking
for a shot like that. To have that ambition in a 21-day shoot, to do it on the last day of shooting, I thought was phenomenal. I can't get over the fact that they all, as a cast and crew, painted and cleaned and refurbished the Myers house, or at least where they had to shoot in that old dilapidated Myers house that they used on the other 20 days for that last day.
Indie film. I don't think that would ever happen these days. Especially, you know, we got people coming up that already think they're superstars, making their first or second film already, that have too much pride to do that type of thing. And here these guys are using their own clothes, pitching and painting leaves, painting walls, trying to make a dilapidated, rundown house at least presentable on film, on camera. all working together. It's amazing.
It's another reason why I love horror movies so much, because it is, it's such a primal genre where you just, you're working on the fear of an audience, the fear, and then the, obviously this, the satisfaction of overcoming that fear throughout a narrative there. And you have filmmakers just being so innovative, from Sam Raimi, like I said, all the way through to Boyega and Guillermo del Toro and so many of them that we've known and loved over the years.
They make the comparison that John Carpenter pulled off. I mean, not to derail you, but get back to that shot, but they made the comparison that that shot was what Orson Welles did in The Third Man.
Right.
I mean, John Carpenter in his second film is doing on a whim, on, like you said, the last day of shooting, pulling off something he said he'd never done before, never tried before, and he's doing what Orson Welles has done.
But he's like, screw it, let's do it. Last day of shooting, this is my confidence level. Amazing. So, second scene, we have the car conversation between Dr. Loomis and the nurse there, where he's and she's chastising him, don't you think we can refer to it as him? And he's like, if you say so. So he's giving us this ominous,
so,
you know,
over the top
send up
it.
Of who Michael is, and they have to take him to a judge, and they're trying to keep him in lockup there at the mental hospital, but the it's legally that he may get out.
And with one little line, the nurse sets up 40 years of panic. Since when are they allowed to wander around?
So we have two opening scenes. We have a child killing his sister.
Brutally!
In an insane situation that is so horrifying. And then the second sequence, we have a mental patient escaping, and they come in upon a setting where it's just a bunch of escaped mental patients.
Just walking around, man.
This is like horror movie gold, right?
That's awesome.
We have an emptied mental hospital after we have the most disgusting killing.
And it sounds so tired and overdone now in 2018, right? Mm-hmm. But at the time, even though it sounds so simple, these things weren't put on film.
Right.
These weren't worked into narrative stories. These weren't put into horror movies. We didn't have these over the top, the deepest, darkest recesses and fears of your mind displayed on screen.
And it's interesting how it hit critics the wrong way from the jump, because they're like, this is a low class film. USC film students, this is a low class film.
And what's most amazing in that aspect is that Roger Ebert, if you read his review, he actually had to defend liking this movie, saying, look, I know it's disturbing. And for 1979, imagine this. He's like, I know it's disturbing that somebody could put this on film, because, of course, look how far we've come. Jesus Christ, this movie is not at all what's most disturbing on film anymore.
No.
But he had this defend. He said, but this is, you have to appreciate auteurs putting their vision out there. And this auteur's vision is to scare the hell out of people.
And good God, we know if you follow true crime, Hitchcock put it on film.
Yep.
And this put it on film. I mean, these things really do freaking happen. You have serial murderers that do this sort of thing. And it's crazy. So we finally go to Haddonfield, Illinois. We meet the youth of Haddonfield, and it starts with our protagonist, Laurie Strode, dropping off a key at the previously abandoned Myers house, this dilapidated old house that real estate agent
father of
Laurie.
How many times do you think we can say the word dilapidated this?
Twice.
Okay.
And that's it. And we sell they're going to sell this house.
I'll take the over.
Michael sees her through the window. We get his heavy breathing.
Oh, what a
we
shot.
See him kind of, you know, staring at not only Lori, but the little kid Tommy,
mm-hmm.
who bumps into Lori, that she's going to babysit him later on that night. They're talking about how they're going to have fun on Halloween. This lonely little kid, it just touches my heart after watching this so many times. His like only friend is his babysitter, who's going to get to watch a scary movie with. He's going to read his comics, the one love of his life. He's going to have her read comics to him, and then they're going to carve a jack-o'-lantern.
Never mind that he becomes one of the only characters that knows what the hell is going on the entire time. But we'll get into that.
We get our first, well, not our first jump scare, but we get a jump scare too here, that loud chord in the score where Michael moves into the frame. Super manipulative, but it works so well. Evil has invaded this little beautiful town.
And there's no motivation. No, all he wanted to, all Michael Myers, if you think about why he's doing this, why he targets Laurie, he doesn't have a reason. That's what makes it so terrifying.
Right.
He just sees Laurie. He's at his home. He sees Laurie come up with the little kid, and he's like, well, going to kill you now.
Yeah, and I kind of love that 2018 is almost retconning the whole motivation for him, and that Halloween 2, we'll talk about it, motivation.
Right, Halloween 2 completely changed the game.
Yeah.
Which, for better or worse, it depends on how you take it, but we'll get into that. But yes, they did try to retcon and make this more important, this moment more familial.
Right. So Michael will stalk Tommy and Laurie over the next few scenes in the full sequence here. He is outside the classroom. that Laurie is getting a class where the line is,
"Can't escape fate."
Yeah, no matter what course of action Collins took, he was destined to his own fate, you know, spoken by the teacher.
If you're a character in a movie, why don't you listen to your teacher?
They never do.
They always tell you what's going to happen.
They never do. So some more highlights from the sequence. We have Laurie, her cheerleader friend Linda, and her friend Annie, who's a snarky, snotty, sarcastic jerk.
And another great touch by Carpenter. And Jamie Lee Curtis is the one that talks about this in the documentary. You've got the encapsulation of what she thinks are the three type of women who exist. You know, the low-key one that always cares about her study, the outgoing cheerleader, the happy, bubbly one, the snarky, smart-ass. And they're just all the personification of these stereotypes right there in front of you.
Their kid personalities turned up to 11, yeah. High school kids that are just completely self-absorbed in their own little world there. And we have Annie as this car slowly passes them and slowly, you know, drives past, and they think it's just a kid from their class. Annie yells at him, "You jerk, speed kills."
"Speed kills, you jerk."
Michael stops.
Oh my
hard.
God. So scary. Back,
shuts them up for a second, just terrifying. And it just really, you think it's go time right then and there.
And right in broad daylight. And that's one of the masterful things Carpenter did throughout this whole screenplay.
But the pacing of this movie is slow, slow,
it's
slow
like a fucking
early
IV
on.
Drip.
And it's crazy how he has so much patience for this. But we have the boogeyman is coming with Tommy and the bullies at the school mixed into this sequence. That is a kind of a scary scene, even though it's a little annoying one. We'll see those bullies again. Tommy falls on the pumpkin. And then perhaps the most disturbing shot in the film, we have the car stalking little boy Tommy, as he walks around the corner back home alone. He is the runt of the litter. He is the injured animal of the herd. And this evil is stalking him. That's, now, again, so disturbing and horrifying for any movie.
The mental imagery, the mental mind game, one of the negatives you could say is, why is there a grown man walking around in overalls and a mask in broad daylight? Well, that's answered Halloween. By it being Halloween. It's okay because it's Halloween. If this was a day earlier or a day later, I would have a huge problem with that Tommy runs into this grown man who's in a mask and an outfit already on school grounds. But yeah, it's totally cool. I get it. It's Halloween. The dude's just trying to get out there. Maybe he's with his kids somewhere.
So these are some best scenes, and this is another best scene for me. So obviously after Michael stops in the car with the girls, We cut back to a scene where he pops out of the shrubbery, and it's just terrifying. And it's in their, you know, the foreground for only Laurie sees it. Annie, they already dropped off Linda. Annie is there not seeing it. She actually just runs to go confront this boy from their high school that she thinks is scaring them.
Which is also says a lot about her character. These are not women that are going to scare easily, you know, and he's taking down these very, very capable, outgoing and really outlandish teenagers.
And Annie makes a game of it and plays one on Laurie there. Oh, this boy wants to talk to you. He wants to go out with you tonight. Here he is. And she gets there and it's nobody.
You're a jerk, Annie.
Yeah. And Annie makes fun of Laurie for seeing men pop up around corners. And it's just, there's totally.
Annie's the one with the big libido. Her sexuality is an overdrive. Laurie's the more repressed one, et cetera, et cetera.
And we also feel for Laurie in that sequence because poor Laurie, you scared another one away, as the quote from Annie.
Sure.
We want Annie to die. But it's fascinating because here's Laurie. She doesn't relate to her friends. Yes, she has friends, but we can relate to Laurie because even though she has a group of friends, she is kind of the one that's smarter than they are. We have a monster predator preying on another outcast in this scenario.
Yeah.
So it's sinful friends are going to die first before Laurie gets preyed upon. But here we got a scenario that is scary.
I can't say it enough how this movie made tropes. Every classic horror movie trope that you think, you have sex in a movie, you're going to die. You don't believe children in a movie, you're going to die. Those only became outdone and overdone tropes because of this movie, because everybody wanted to repeat the success of Halloween. They were done for the first time here.
Right. And yet the kind of principle, the screenwriting, storytelling principle goes all the way back to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and that, you know, think about if you take God science, if you play God, you will die. Frankenstein, you will die. your monster will come back and get you. Your whatever, your creation, your scientific creation. If you mess with God's timeline, you're going to get
it. Yeah, the derivative of these screenwriting principles, too, is we start with the Mary Shelley's. We create these tropes for the first time in Halloween. And now we've gotten to the point with Cabin in the Woods, and where it's become so meta, they can be sarcastic on themselves and be parodies of themselves while still being scared. The evolution of screenwriting is just, it's amazing if you really stop and think about it.
Fascinating. Because the audiences get smarter. Yeah. But here we are, the audience at its most manipulated, and it still works today. Sure. It still holds up. So some of my worst stuff, it's not that worse. It's awesomely bad.
But I'm not going to hear this.
Officer Brackett. La, 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 la. Officer Brackett. Everything with Officer Brackett kind of bothers me a little bit. He bumps into Lori after Michael freaks her out, and he's getting dropped off. It's Halloween. I guess everybody's entitled to one good scare, eh? That line will come
up
again.
Did you get it?
This is just a dumb cop. He's also creepy how he almost turns and watches the girl walk away. But he's a terrible cop.
Yeah, I don't disagree that there's certainly more that could be done by the Haddonfield PD throughout this movie. But I just wanted to highlight one of the best things for me throughout this movie is what Carpenter doesn't make any safe spaces. This is broad daylight. True. And we have this, literally this shape, this guy who we have not gotten a clear picture of even. We just see from a distance on angles,
right,
from his torso down, et cetera, et cetera. But he's everywhere in this young girl's life. I never really realized how much he stalked Lori during the day, as well as the other two girls, as well as Tommy as well. You know, absolutely. Lori walking home, he's there in a car. Tommy Doyle gets bullied, he's there to confront Tommy after he runs away from the kids. Lori looks out of her classroom window, he's there in the middle of the day. Walking home and she's next to the grove. She looks outside her window, he's among the sheets hanging on the clothesline. I mean, it's really, you get this presence, this idea that the world is getting smaller.
Right.
Everything's closing in on her, and it's this evil presence that's getting closer and closer and closer.
And it's suspense filmmaking 101. The audience must know more than the characters.
Yeah.
Because we are shown Dr. Loomis chasing Michael and going on his way to Haddonfield, chasing the plot, really. He sees the trail that Michael Myers has left, the Phelps garage truck that Michael Myers, we don't know, or Loomis doesn't know, killed the owner or operator of that tow truck and took his, you know, basically his jumpsuit, right? And it pans over to the dead man in the hay field, the hay pile.
So if the shot is constructed in such a way that Loomis is inspecting this now vacated truck,
He knows something
happened, and if he would just turn the corner another foot away, he would see this dead body of this mechanic laying on the side of this hayfield.
Like you said, Annie is basically conditioning Lori to think that it's just another kid in their school playing tricks on them because, oh, I've recognized that car. Nobody thinks there's really evil walking about. So again, we know as an audience the danger that Michael brings at this point after, you know, the dead body that we see with Loomis, but yet Lori planning her night with her babysitting friends. Now they're rationalizing it in another way. No, that's just my old neighbor watching you dress.
Yeah, and the incidental setup too. Like how this script is so tight because everything you need for the big crescendo finale is already addressed throughout the different plot points in the script through normal dialogue and conversation. Like you said, when Brackett stops Lori and Annie when they're smoking pot driving by, they get rid of it because the police are investigating a break-in at the hardware store. Oh, it's just some kids that all they took was a mask, a rope, and a knife.
You write away the obvious objection.
It's so beautiful.
And this is what the MCU does. This is screenwriting principles 101, suspense filmmaking 101. The characters talk away what they're afraid of and what they should be afraid of. What the audience knows they should be afraid
of. And it's presented in such a way, Brackett's like, oh, yeah, so they just took a mask, a knife, you know, crazy kids, right?
Crazy kids taken on Halloween. If it wasn't Halloween, that wouldn't have worked.
Exactly.
If they stole knives any other day of the year, it wouldn't have worked. But they took a Halloween mask. They took some rope. They took some knives. It's part of a costume, right? It makes sense. It makes sense to the audience.
I would like investigation as to why the Haddonfield Hardware Store was the only place in America selling a painted white William Shatner mask. I think investigation needs to be done into that.
That's true. Or maybe he just took the William Shatner mask and did it. What Schmave and the wonderful people at this 21-day production did. So,
yes.
I just love that scene again to go back to it after number one, the curtains blowing. It's a sign of things to come.
How ominous.
Every Halloween movie.
Forethought.
That freaked me out having watched all the other movies recently. And it's freaky how Jamie Lee Curtis's face really does like a shudder in that scene. I love her performance in this movie.
She's great in this.
When she slams the thing, she is totally freaked out. But then again, she talks herself out of it. Annie talks her out of it. You buy the fact that she is trying to shake it off. Like this, she couldn't have seen this shape.
Right.
couldn't have seen.
Right.
No way.
It's Halloween. I'm spooking myself out.
I'm spooking myself out. Annie's telling me that it's not a big deal. I'm not the only one. Tommy's going to be afraid of the boogeyman later, and I have to be strong for this kid. There is no boogeyman. You're saying things. It's nonsense. Blah,
which is
blah,
the
blah.
Irony of ironies, because Tommy's the one that actually saves the day at the end.
It's phenomenal. So Annie and Laurie, like you said, carpool, and they visit Officer Brackett, who doesn't smell an old 1970s joint in the car.
He's just not a great cop.
He's not a great cop. Again, he may have smelt it, and yet he's letting his daughter off because he doesn't want to deal with it. I don't know. You can rationalize it, but it's whatever. I think stealing weapons any other day of the year would have been an alarm bell sound.
Yeah, but think about it, Mike. They don't even know it's weapons at this point. It's just a guy that wants a rope and knife.
So we cut to the night. The girls are going to their babysitting jobs. Michael is stalking these girls outside of their place.
And how genius is it to have it all on one street? They just both happen to have babysitting jobs the same night on the same street.
Loomis and Brackett, they're investigating the Myers house where apparently Michael ate a dog.
Yeah, that was gross.
Gross. We realize Loomis is packing when something crashes into a window. We get another jump scare there.
Another foreshadowing,
too. And we get some big speeches out of Dr. Loomis, and only a good actor can play these off, as we've seen in Anthony Hopkins. He's always gets the exposition dumps in every movie because he can handle
this
it. He can make it cinematic.
This is a very Anthony Hopkins-esque performance, yes.
I met this six-year-old child with blank stare, pale, emotionless face with the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. It's the purely and simply evil speech that Donald Pleasance gives to Officer Brackett there. Officer Brackett's like, you, and again, talking away the silly nonsense exposition dump of it all this fancy talk is not going to keep me,
right,
you know, out with you all night. I love that. You speak away even the exposition dump. It's just so smart.
8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up because I realized what was lying behind those eyes.
It's the filmmakers telling the audience, we know we're setting you up with some monologuing here, but here.
Come along for the ride.
Yeah, let's do this. And this, let's paint the picture and let's make him more ominous. So Lori's babysitting Tommy, who's petrified.
And by the way, it only works because Loomis is kind of a quack as well.
Yeah.
I mean, he's able to get away with this kind of direct exposition because he's a kooky character.
Absolutely kooky. Just look at the looks he gives, the eyes he gives. So Lori's babysitting Tommy, petrified of the boogeyman. She's reading him comics. They talk about the boogeyman. Annie is babysitting a little girl named Lindsay across the street as Michael stalks them both. He stalks Annie first, kills Lindsay's family dog. That's the girl Annie's babysitting. Mm-hmm. Tommy sees Michael across the street during the sequence. Michael's heavy breathing, watching Annie undress, is also freaky after she spills butter on her shirt. She changes into a large white dress shirt, hanging around, I guess, and goes to do the laundry in the garage. That's a long, I don't want to say, I mean, it's just a suspense building sequence where you think she's going to get it. You think she's going to get it for, you know, 5 minutes. Right?
It's important, too, that we have, still at this point in the movie, we're an hour plus into the movie, and we haven't gotten to a point where Michael's actually in the room with any of these people.
Right.
He's just getting closer and closer, and now he's literally at the back door watching Annie spill butter on herself.
The patience of the filmmakers here
Such a slow drip.
And not to have the monster show what he can do yet is crazy. So Laurie and Tommy watch Howard Hawks' The Thing. Tommy is worried about the boogeyman, like we've said. Laurie says she'll protect him. So you have this quote-unquote speech from the hero of the story saying, I will protect the kids. She's saying it not thinking she has to do it.
Right. She's saying it as just to get his mind off the boogeyman.
Dramatic irony there if there ever was some. It's just wonderful. So Annie, after she kind of connects with her boyfriend over the phone there from Lindsay, getting her out of the locked laundry room garage, Annie brings Lindsay over to Tommy's house. So that she and Paul
Annie wants to go hook up with her boyfriend, Paul. She's babysitting. She brings the girl she's babysitting for, Lindsay, over to watch movies with Tommy and basically says to Laurie Strode, Jamie Lee Curtis's character, can you just watch them for me?
You'll just watch them. Yeah, I'm going to go get some hanky-panky here. So Annie is about to go see her boyfriend, Paul, with the car, and Michael pops up in the back seat.
Even the fog, how the fog was on the outside of the car and not the inside.
Oh, creepy.
Temperature difference. And that was a gruesome scene. That was a very visceral human scene where she's getting choked to death. And that's one of the things the documentary touches on as well, is this, there's so little blood. But the theater of the mind is so vivid.
And he snaps her neck, and then you get the big...
Yeah.
It's scary. I don't like the face she makes. I don't like the track and the sound where they duplicate.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't like those two things as me being a film critic nitpicking there, but I like that sequence. And now you're freaked out. All right. So now it's going.
He's time. Actually done something.
Now he's done something.
As all opposed right. to just killing a dog.
Loomis is still outside of the Myers house. Those three bullies come back there and he says, "Hey, Lonnie, get your ass away from there." And the bully freaks out. Brackett, of course, scares Dr. Loomis again, because Brackett is the freaking scare guy just as much as Michael is. Officer Brackett, as many scares as Michael Myers at this point in the movie. Here we have, again, the death has come to your little town speech.
Death has come to your little town tonight.
They can't stake out Michael from the Myers house any longer. They have to do their rounds, and that's what they do from then on. Now, Linda and her boyfriend Bob, they're out gallivanting in their van, drinking beers, and figured they had plans to meet up with Annie and Paul at this point.
Yeah, weird. Everyone was just
They were going to surprise Annie and Paul.
Well, regardless, everybody was going to Annie's house to hook up. That's
weird. The long talk short about of it. Worst place at the wrong time.
We're here for the gangbang?
Wrong place. Wrong place at wrong time. So, of course, Bob and Linda, PJ and John Michael there, they go into the house. They think they're going to see Annie and Paul. They see nobody.
Annie's not there. The little girl Lindsay's not there. They have the house to themselves. They call Lori. And they're like, "Where is anyone?" And Lori says, "Oh, Annie's just out trying to get Paul. I think she's picking him up."
So, of course, they go up to the parents' bedroom and hook up.
Tisk, tisk, tisk.
Sins committed. Michael will be in this house. And he's just killed Annie in this house. And he's in a closet in this house. So when Bob goes to get Linda a beer.
Infamous.
Michael pops out of the closet.
Don't put anything on. I'll be right back.
Don't get dressed.
Yeah, don't get. I'll be right back. Don't get dressed is the quote. There's another horror movie
famous
trope.
Last words. Michael pins him against the wall, raises him up, stabs him with the butcher knife.
Probably the most iconic kill from this movie.
Feet death, as John Michael Graham is very proud of. His death just dies. His feet die first.
Feet dangling, yep.
And Michael tilts his head and looks up.
Oh, what a creepy touch.
So Michael walks upstairs, of course.
And this follows immediately probably the most famous scene in the movie where Ghost Michael... who is trying to pass himself off as Bob, is in the bed seat and in Bob's glasses. It's such the subtext of how you're just playing a game. You're a goofy boyfriend playing a game under the girlfriend.
It's scary. It's funny in a way. Now you, as an audience member, because you're getting too dark, let's have some games and silly, fun and Halloween tricks.
It also substantiates the antagonist as more than just this mindless killing machine. Right. He shows his quickness. He shows his ingenuity. He shows his
cerebral
power.
Wit.
Yeah. I mean, this is an actual, he may not be human, but he has human qualities.
Audiences will admire capability just the same way they do with Hannibal Lecter. They do with Michael Myers here. So you have a scummy serial murderer who's killed a dog, who's killed a babysitter, killed another two, a babysitter and her boyfriend. But here he's got a flair for showmanship.
Yes, he's a big fan of misdirection.
So Michael goes upstairs in the bed. She kills Linda with a telephone wire while she's on the phone with Lori, who thinks it's Annie calling her.
Yes.
So terrible misunderstanding here. The lights pop on because Michael pops them on because he's going to stage all of them in their death throes for whomever, for the cops, for Lori. Lori thinks that, all right, Annie's back with Paul. Annie was calling me to screw around.
The subtext in all this. You're building this story in your mind because of how well it's written out. You completely understand why Lori is confused and why she's exactly what her confusion is, what the misdirection is, what the story in her mind is versus what the story we know happened actually is. It's just genius.
So we're heading into our finale. The B story is finally colliding with Dr. Loomis seeing the stolen car that he was driving.
I have a problem with that. Because all that reveal is Loomis turning around and saying, "Wait a minute, isn't that the car from the sanitarium?
Why wasn't that
there
car
the
being,
whole time?
Yeah, but yeah, why wasn't that car being looked for
right,
by the cops?
I have a problem with that being the moment, but it's
anyway,
whatever.
B story collides towards after the midpoint where Lori walks in to investigate the house across the street, Lindsay's house. Lindsay's over there with Tommy and the little girl, and she sees the gravestone of Judith Myers over a bed with a dead Annie splayed out. She backs into a closet with a dead Bob hanging from the ceiling with the rope that Michael had. And then she bumps into, kind of rolls over along the wall, bumps into a shelf with Linda stuffed in the shelf.
Here are all your friends' corpses.
Staggering from the scene and crying. She's about to get herself out of the house. No, moonlight.
Oh, my God. Single light bulb. Yeah, shows Michael Myers' face right there, ready to stab her.
My favorite image of the film, scary as iconic. Hell. Michael Myers doesn't have good eyesight through the moonlight, because...
I hate that. He's been so accurate the whole movie.
He needs to strangle... I don't know. Maybe I am going to be the guy to be the apologist here, because he hasn't had a lot of moving targets to hit. I know. Horror movie trope. Miss the protagonist.
Right. You just missed the final girl.
He hits the final girl in the shoulder. She falls down the stairs.
Yes.
Breaks her ankle, as we'll learn in Halloween 2.
And now we're on. We got the cat and mouse game. It's totally on at this point.
So Michael stalks her across the street. She's banging on the door. Tommy, open it. Tommy, open up. Tommy, open up. The kids were sleeping before. Tommy wakes up, opens it in the nick of time.
What a scene, too. That she's pounding and pounding and pounding, needs Tommy to open the door. And we keep getting these cutbacks to Michael just slowly walking across, because he doesn't want to make a scene. It's still Halloween night. It's a man in a mask. He can get away with this. He's just slowly making his way across the street, closer and closer to her, before Tommy finally opens up at the last second.
And it also brings everything together. The audience does not know any more than the characters now. The audience and the characters are together. So you're brought into what? You're brought into the POV of the protagonist from then on. Laurie's POV, that's genius writing. It's formulaic, but it's worked so well. You have a third act about to hit where she does battle with your villain. POV, again, genius writing here. And she gets into the house, and what do we see again?
That open window.
Open window. And now she knows, oh shit. And I don't know how she knows, but she knows he's here. And she cowers at the base of the couch, grabs a sewing needle just in the nick of time, but cowering, crying mess, it's fight or flight. She's about to flee, and yet Michael peers
above.
Pops up.
It was a legitimately scary jump scare.
Again, misses the stab.
Which I'm okay with there, because she was reacting.
Tilting.
She gets the hell out of the way, spins, stabs him in the neck.
Awesome. And it's fight.
Yeah, we're going.
It's fight and it's flight, and she thinks she's killed him.
Mm-hmm. Because
of course, normal people die that way. It's not
stabbed
a
right
person.
In the neck. Now, right in the jugular, actually, and she thinks he's dead. So we have this moment with Tommy.
Mm-hmm.
She goes upstairs. She's like, "Listen, Tommy, Lindsay, go down the street, go to the neighbor's house, have them call the cops, get the cops here because they're going to save the day. They're those very capable Haddonfield PD." Tommy says, "Where's the boogeyman?" Basically, and Laurie says, "He's not going to worry you anymore. I killed him." And Tommy, who's one of two characters who actually knows what's going on this entire movie,
right?
It's him and Dr. Loomis, and that's it. They're the most probably unique characters. Tommy's the only one that's sure he's seen the shape, that knows that shape has killed someone.
Yes.
He's seen Michael carrying a dead body across the road. He's the only one who did it. The only person that he can get to believe him is the other child, Lindsay.
Right.
And Tommy, in that moment, says, "You can't kill the boogeyman." And then Michael's back,
stalks them. She actually heroically gets the kids to a point of somewhat safety, locks them in the door, pushes them over. With her broken ankle, she stumbles back into the bedroom, into the closet. We get the infamous closet scene where she has the presence of mind to lock the closet with one of her scarves. Yeah, and she locks the closet door. Michael punches through the door. She's like, "All right, I got to fight again. I love this." She grabs a hanger off the rack. She somehow makes the hanger into a poking mechanism. She doesn't grip it from afar. She grips it almost close to the thing. So she's got to get close quarters and medieval on his ass.
CQC, yeah.
She grips it only with a little bit of a poker off the end of it and stabs
right in the eye.
Right in the eye. He drops the knife. She stabs
him. Does it again.
With the kitchen
knife.
Talk
about a capable protagonist.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. He backs away, flops down the ground. Now,
and by the way, Jamie Lee Curtis, throughout all this, the terror in her face, knowing that she's fighting for her life and knowing that she's facing a madman that just wants to kill him.
Really,
she's going off. It's so good.
She plays that normal high school kid, that virgin who hasn't gotten laid yet with the sexualized friend. She plays that girl next door kind of deal without the boyfriend, without the adherence to all what the other kids want to do with their lives. And she's kind of that one that you relate to, that outcast in a little bit.
Yeah.
And yet we have her also playing the thriller protagonist.
The
we
hero
have
in all of
it's
us.
It's like
yeah.
a Daniel Kaluuya-like performance in
it
many
is.
Ways.
It
because
is.
She's not as showcased as Kaluuya was in Get Out, but it's that kind of performance.
Absolutely. 100%.
So We have Tommy and Lindsay running across the street screaming.
They finally get out, trying to get somebody's attention.
Dr. Loomis is in the neighborhood. He's the huntsman from Snow White here. He is going to come in at the nick of time. He sees the kids screaming. He charges into the house. At that point, we have crying, wilting Lori, but behind
it's
him.
Just great shot her, after great shot after great shot.
The iconic.
Lori's down, crying. She's sliding against the wall, sitting down. She thinks it's all over again for the second time.
The music strikes up once more, though, and Michael raises.
In the background,
like,
out of
dead.
Focus, Michael, like the Undertaker in WWE, just sits up.
Or the Undertaker like Michael.
How dare you? It's just, he's not dead yet. And again, there's that horror trope being done for the first time. It's highlighted in the documentary as well, but yeah, we're used to seeing the big monsters come back over and over through sequels. We're not used to seeing an unkillable personification of evil here.
Right, so that's the big twist on the story, that it is the boogeyman, and Michael comes up, starts strangling her. There is Dr. Loomis, though, fires one shot, fires five more. I didn't love the Nick Castle mannerisms, like the bushwhackers there flying off out.
I didn't like that she got
the
his
window.
Mask off.
And yes, that's the big move. She gets his mask off for a second there, played by another actor, not Nick
that.
Castle.
Yeah.
He's got a little weird eye. I don't know if that's the poked eye. Obviously, it probably is.
Yeah.
And Michael flies out, and in a great shot, he's splayed onto the ground, shot six times, bloody torso. So he doesn't have a bulletproof vest or whatever, but he's bloody torso. He's on the ground, splayed out. Now you have the tete-a-tete that's infamous. Lori crying. She goes, "It was the boogeyman." And Dr. Loomis says, as a matter of fact, it was. And then he looks back out there. Michael's gone. Michael's gone. They look at each other, and Lori just knows. She doesn't even need to look.
Oh,
she knows.
God.
She just freaks the hell out. Michael's gone. Dr. Loomis is just staggered. And we get this series of shots of the neighborhood. Michael could be anywhere. The quick shots that Tommy Lee Wallace basically edited out of establishing shots they had earlier in the film.
What a great outro, too. Great touch.
It worked.
There's so
montage.
Many little touches in this movie that went into it that just played perfectly.
And if you have any doubt that Michael's still alive, you get the heavy breathing to end the movie with the music.
And the 17 sequels. A little tip off there.
So it's an all-timer.
Listen, I don't think this is the reason we did this one alone separately as well. We did the Halloween 3 because it was non-Michael Myers, had some fun with it. But this one is actually, you can learn so much from any perspective, whether it's being a horror fan, a writer, director, actor. There's so much little nuances that went into this freaking movie being the classic that it is.
And I think we hit on a lot of the storytelling capability that Carpenter had. We hit a lot of the technique throughout. We hit on a lot of the screenwriting principle. And I think this movie works as a story, first and foremost.
And how simple is the story?
Yeah.
Madman kills babysitters. Yeah. That's the story that you're working off of. And now you're getting into, well, okay, who's the madman? Why is he called Michael Myers? What's his motivation? He doesn't really have, you know, is he the personification of evil? No, he's the boogeyman. He's everyone's fear. Inherent.
It works because you're guessing what his motivation is, and then you're told at the end, oh, he is pure evil. And that's
and
the
it's
scariest
kind
part.
Of why the sequels lose their way a little bit, because they try to turn him into a person. As opposed to a force.
He'll just be killing family members.
Right.
Run. So it's every time you add something, it diminishes what he's. What
ironically,
he
it
is.
Takes something away, yeah.
And the law of diminishing returns throughout the sequels. We'll break them down two at a time, but we'll get Halloween 2018 for a movie event in a couple weeks here, where basically the folks over there.
That
Dave
is
Gordon
the
Green.
Direct sequel to this.
Yes.
Nothing
Jeez.
Else in the Halloween, and this is kind of where does this fit in the Halloween universe? Well, one, it's the kickoff. Two, it's one of the pillars of horror ever,
yes.
Cinematic horror. But this is the movie that you need to familiarize yourself with, and another reason we decided to do this in a solo effort, because this is the first part. David Gordon Green's movie coming out on the 19th is going to be the second part. We don't know if there's going to be more after that. We're going to have to wait and see. But that's the direct sequel to this. So this, as far as through lines, as far as storylines, as far as whatever you're going to need to worry about, you need to know this movie in terms to fully appreciate what's coming out on October 19th in David Gordon Green's Halloween.
Yes.
We're going to have our fun with the other storylines. And this is kind of the Jamie Lee Curtis, the Laurie Strode storyline. Think of this as the starting point. There's different diversions, different branches on the tree that we're going to go down. But right now, the trunk is this one. and then hopefully Halloween 2018 that comes out.
So we've joined a group on Twitter, All the Horror. They're all over the place.
Hashtag
now.
All the Horror, yes.
Hashtag All the Horror. It's a group of podcasts that we know and like and have enjoyed becoming friends with over the past month or so.
A lot of great talent there, too.
And we're going to do our own episode for them. We're all tagging all our horror themed episodes throughout the month, so go seek them out. We'll have, like we said, a Halloween themed episode directly for that feed, but we'll also be releasing a bunch of these Halloween series reviews, of course, throughout the rest of the month. All the Horror, seek them out.
Yeah, great highlight there from you. Definitely go check out. There's a lot of talented podcasts that we're just honored to be included in among and being a part of that group. Like Mike said, we're going to have something exclusive for that feed. As far as what we're doing in the immediate future, we're still, you guys just heard, A Star Is Born, our Oscar Sprint profile on that. We plan on doing another one next week for First Man. We have, October's pretty booked with both Oscars and horror stuff that we plan on getting to, and that's going to be the bulk of the month.
The Vice trailer's out. We'll do an Oscar trailer five at some point, and you like those. We'll keep the previews and the reviews coming.
And that's pretty much your month of October from us. As far as what we're going to do with the Halloween stuff next, next episode's going to be the immediate sequel. So we're finishing out the Laurie Strode storyline as they were up through 1998.
I loved watching these movies, so we're going to have a lot to talk about. So Halloween 2 and Halloween H2O.
It's just masturbation on my part. No. It's just serious masturbation.
Gross. But fun.
We're going to have Halloween 2 and H2O. Going to combine those. That'll be the finishing of the Laurie Strode storyline, which again will once again hit on what's happening in 2018 with Halloween and how kind of juxtapose where she was in that storyline compared to where we think she is now in 2018 and how David Gordon Green's going to treat her. That'll be a fun little take. And then we have 4 and 5, which is going to be its own episode. The Rob Zombie remakes, which will be its own episode. Direction 6 and Resurrection, I'm not sure what we're doing yet because those are just great. I love those. Okay. 6 might be my favorite Halloween movie. It's out there. I know it's Paul Rudd's.
And then we'll have that All the Horror spin-off episode for you as well.
And like we said, we're working hard to try to bust our butts, give you guys all sorts of content, both Oscars related, which is our bread and butter, and horror related, because everybody seems to appreciate and love horror movies as much as we do.
And we're working our butts off.
So make sure you stick with us, Mike. Whether you need the drama, whether you need the scares, we got it all covered for you. Make sure you follow us at Mike and Oscar on Facebook, Mike and Oscar on Instagram, MM and Oscar on the Twitter machine, MikeMikeAndOscar.com at gmail.com, and on Reddit. We're hoping, we actually have an update on the website again. We're hoping the website will be done hopefully in November, December-ish. We had to put it on pause because we're just doing too much here with the podcast. So we kind of had to kick that can down the road as well.
We're working hard for you guys.
So yeah, guys, reach out to us. Make sure you follow All the Horror. What are your thoughts?
6 degrees of MMO. Get us those responses.
Of course. And what are your thoughts on what you think you're going to see on the 19th? Have you seen the movie already? If you spoil it for me, I'll kill you. But if you've seen it, let me know what you thought about it.
Oh, my God.
For some reason, I just get this bloodlust now.
You relate too much to the antagonists.
How amazing is it, though? We didn't touch on it. And it was a big part of the documentary. We didn't really talk about it. But you've had murder after murder after murder after stabbing after strangling after everything. No blood in this movie. Absolutely no blood. Just a great touch. Mm-hmm. Totally theater.
Very true.
Yeah, guys, reach out to us. We want to know your thoughts on this episode, any others, any of the Oscar Sprint profiles we've done. Mike, any final words of wisdom here?
Was that the boogeyman? As a matter of fact, it was.
Yeah.
That's the quote again. I said the quote again.
He did the thing.
I did it.
Guys, reality sucks. Keep watching movies with us. We will check you out next time.
See ya.